Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
In 2019, the University of Otago celebrated its 150th anniversary.
As part of the celebrations, we devised a creative writing competition for our staff and students.
We called the competition Writer and invited entries of either poetry or prose.
As it was the 150th year, our writing prompt was based on the university motto, Daring to be Wise.
Our judge, Fiona Farrell, chose the winners from around 70 entries from all of the university's campuses. Benjamin Clow won the student prose category with The Life of George Song, Chapter 3, University Days. Benjamin's completing a coursework master's in English. His story was called The Life of George Song, and the work pretended to be part of a much larger biography, and he called it Chapter 3, University Days. Fiona, what stood out to you about this entry?
Well, to start with, the fact that he did call it Chapter 3, I just found that started it off. The whole thing was a wonderfully ironic take on the story of coming to university. It was a kind of coming of age. It was a coming of age story, and there are any number of novels that are coming of age stories, but this one compressed it all into these 2,500 words. It was witty. It was immensely witty. It parodied the academic biography. It had teasing fake footnotes and a style that was quite pompous to tell a story about arriving at Otago and encountering all the things that are normal in a coming-of-age story, you know, finding out about sex and death and brutality and all these things. And then there's this wonderful epiphany at the end where the hero, George, is in the toilets at the Regent Theatre, and through the wall he can hear the Dunedin Symphony Orchestra practising Wagner. And it's this amazing scene that just made me laugh out loud. But it was extremely clever, very well written. Yeah, I think he's got a great future.
Thanks, Fiona. It's now our pleasure to introduce you to Benjamin. Hi, Benjamin, and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Benjamin, tell us about your work.
Yeah, sure. So I heard about the competition. I really wanted to enter, but I didn't really know what to do with the prompt, which was Dare to be Wise. So I talked to a few people and I talked to my dad, and dad on the phone started giving different sort of definitions of wisdom, talked about what the Bible said about wisdom, talked about university and people trying to get knowledge and get skills for their life. And at that same time, I was taking a biography paper at university in which we were sort of half reading famous biographies and the other half sort of writing our own biographies of famous people. And I thought it would be interesting to sort of combine the two and write a fictional piece about a fictional character, but write about him like he was a real guy.
Awesome. Now we're going to hear Benjamin's story. And one of the interesting things about it is that he has echoed those biographies. So it features footnotes and references. And Nicola is going to read them for us.
From The Life of George Song, Chapter 3, University Days. A chapter needs to be given to George Song's Otago days. Even though they were brief, it was here Song started to exhibit the qualities and characteristics which he would soon be known for globally. That is, his writing, his love of adventure, and his faith. With two suitcases filled with books and warm clothes, Song left his parents' home in Napier for Dunedin in late February 2017 to study law. His parents had to rush up to Auckland for a funeral, so Song hitchhiked to Wellington, slept on a bus shelter bench in Miramar opposite Weta Workshops, and took the early flight to Dunedin. Having chosen to neglect the shuttle service offered by the university, he started walking from the airport to the city. He only accepted a ride after it began to rain so much that he couldn't see a metre in front of him. A local farm vet picked him up from the side of the road, and having been asked why he didn't organise a ride, Song replied, "I like the challenge and I want to be different."
Footnote 1. B. Nelson. 10 Crazy O-Week Stories in The Otago Annual, edited Terence Young and B. Broccoli, Dunedin, Signal Publications, 2018, pages 34 to 36.
Song's first year is still unclear. Unable to get into his first choice, Arana, Song was accepted into the newly established Heritage College, situated up towards Roslyn near the Moana Pool.
Footnote 2. S. Mendes and C. Fukunaga. Heritage College, A History. Dunedin, University of Wisdom Press, 2038, pages 9 to 11.
According to a number of eyewitness accounts, he attended a number of flat parties on both Hyde and Castle Street. He could not keep his room tidy, having failed all his room inspections. He attended lectures irregularly, but never missed a tutorial. One tutor described Song tutorial habits as unbelievable. He would barely attend lectures, never did a reading, but could talk for most of the lesson about the topic, despite being heavily critical of the content.
Footnote 3. John Glenn. Interviews with Song's Past. Edendale. Wyndham Books, 2038, page 44.
Song's pre-conversion days have naturally been exaggerated. But the biggest critic of them all has been Song himself, who describes his early life as a long, unruly scream for help. Duncan Browning, who didn't properly meet Song until their second year, describes seeing him at a first few year parties. Lost souls, many of us were, searching for something which we never found.
Footnote 4. Duncan Browning. Through It All. Auckland. True Life Press, 2045, pages 24 to 25.
An old first-year flame, Ruby Lynham, claimed that Song was exceedingly well-behaved for a boyfriend, to the extent of being called a prude. It's not that he had a very low opinion of sex, it's the fact that he seemed to have a very high opinion of it, and because of that, it never was a topic of conversation. If he was tempted to try something on with me, in which I would have been keen, he never mentioned anything. He would get drunk and discuss Nietzsche with me, but I never once saw him with his top off.
Footnote 5. Glenn, Song's Past, pages 121 to 2.
There were two different narratives concerning Ruby and Song's split. The first, and by far the more sensational story, involves Song coming back from a Queenstown trip to find Ruby hiding cannabis in his sock drawer. There is no evidence for this, apart from a few malicious rumours. What was most likely was boredom. Song had become restless within his mind. Nearing the end of his first year, he attended more parties than usual, but would never drink. Instead, parties were for talking to people. It was here that he began to be noticed and known amongst Heritage College. He hated his room, and when the RAs didn't catch him, he would sleep on the sofa in the lounge room by the vending machines.
Footnote 6. George Song, My Life in Fragments. Prague, Fireproof Productions, 2029, page 56.
A series of construction work began in the dining room and recreational rooms of Heritage College in October, forcing Song back into his room.
Footnote 7. Mendes and Fukunaga, Heritage College, page 99.
It was at this time that he disappeared. He didn't attend any of his end-of-year examinations. The weekly payments to the hall and the odd going-well text to his parents eased off any intervention. Many claim to have seen Song in this two-month period, yet most of the stories seem unlikely. Song's biographer, R. Moore, claims that this time was the beginning of Song's conversion and that he spent a lot of his time at the Knox Church in town, his knees scuffed by the prayers he was making to a god he was unsure of.
Footnote 8. R. Moore, A Critical Biography of George Song, North Carolina, Elon University Publication, 2056, pages 457 to 59.
The main justification for this is his classmates seeing him, distraught, with a big book in his hand, wandering on George Street by the Knox Church. I propose a more believable argument for Song's missing 2 months. Having grown tired of university life and his studies, Song had given up to focus on his own interested studies. His library card was still active over the two-month period in which he took out a number of modernist and postmodernist books. Song, while being spotted by his classmates, was probably on his way to or back from the Governor's Cafe, a long-running student haunt opposite the Knox Church, which has a quiet upstairs reading room. The large book spotted in his hands wasn't the King James, but instead a copy of James Joyce's Ulysses, a book he later mentions reading at university. In my most pretentious stage, I read Ulysses to impress a girl. It was ghastly and confusing, and I think I loved every minute of it.
Footnote 9. George Song, My Literary Journey. London, Dead Rose Press, 2032, page 22.
Song stayed over the summer and moved to live in the flat at Ulverston Manor, above the traditional part of the house, which still did guided tours. Song was at his happiest. He read lots and got a bit more money through writing a chess column in the local paper. And over the summer period, Song met the Free Church minister, Daniel Lawrenson, who had come from Scullaway, Shetland Islands, for a sabbatical. The two met by chance, and Lawrenson wrote about him in a postcard to his son in Aberdeen. "Met this rather pompous undergrad this morning in the animal attic at the museum here. He quoted either Keats or Wordsworth at me and asked my views on evolution. Catching up for lunch tomorrow. Poor man probably doesn't have any friends."
Footnote 10. Daniel Lawrenson, Faith and Practice. Lyric, Highlands and Skylands, 2025, page 42.
For the next 2 months before classes in 2018 started, the two unlikely companions met weekly. Song brought his questions, and Lawrenson did his best to answer them. Song allowed his testimony to be published on the Free Church website back in Scotland. "Christianity didn't arrive to me when I was low, when I thought I needed it, at a time when I was feeling depressed or down. On the contrary, God gripped me when I didn't think I needed him at all. Life was going swell, and then out of nowhere I was faced with the reality of my sin, the holiness of a living God, and salvation through Jesus Christ."
Footnote 11. Lawrenson, Faith, page 50.
It was on Lawrenson's last day that Song was baptised. The two had met up at St. David's Cafe and were then strolling by the Leith and the clock tower, preparing to say their final goodbyes. It was there that Song suggested getting baptised, right there on campus. If any student or lecturer had been on campus that day, they may have seen one 19-year-old and one 60-year-old down by the Leith. They took their shoes and socks off, rolled their trousers up to their knees, and stepped into the fast-flowing stream. In front of God, in front of the clock tower and the university, it felt right. It was the wisest decision I'd ever made, and it was all God.
Footnote 12. Song, Life in Fragments, page 71.
Lawrenson's last task before leaving New Zealand on that same day was to install Song in the Christian flat. A room opened up in Duncan Browning's flat, and Song moved in at the beginning of his second year. Duncan Browning was a student of history whose greatest strength was listening. He studied finance and played rugby for the university team, each with equal enjoyment. Browning and Song's flat was a two-minute walk to the university campus, opposite the North Field and near the Scribes bookstore.
Footnote 13. T. Dalton. Dunedin in the early 21st century. Wellington, Sunshine Daily Publications, 2061, page 567.
Also in the flat was Amelia Nightingale, on exchange from Prince Edward Island, Canada. Nightingale, at that time, was working on her first novel, Pemba Reef, published 3 years later while back in Canada. In an email back to Lawrenson, Song described her as praying for Chinese missionaries and uni students with the same level of fervency.
Footnote 14. The selected letters, emails and Facebook communications of George Song. Edited, P. Brosnan, London, Dead Rose Press, 2061, page 23.
Nightingale remembered meeting Song 2 weeks before Song attended the Bible study. It must have been shortly after his conversion. His room was always messy. I thought he was an old man in a young man's body. He once sat by me at a combined citywide church service. He turned to me and asked why they weren't singing any hymns.
Footnote 15. Amelia Nightingale. Running Away from Green Gables, a Memoir. Prague, Fireproof Publications, 2059. Page 113.
Song didn't last long in Pentecostal churches, unlike Browning, although he did feel that a lot of the enthusiasm was genuine. He soon developed an insatiable appetite for Puritan authors, Owen, Baxter, and Sibbes. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, the Welsh minister who preached in Westminster Chapel, became a firm favourite also, with Amelia Nightingale confirming that if there were any earphones in Song's ears, it would always be a Lloyd-Jones sermon.
Footnote 16. G. Lazenby, The Man Behind the Song. New York, Atonement Limited, 2063, page 88.
He attended a Reformed church with Nightingale.
Footnote 17. Nightingale, Green Gables, page 125.
In March, Song entered a novel writing competition in which he did not receive a placing. Song's novel was a Gothic murder mystery set amongst the churches, bookstores, and coffee shops of Dunedin. Browning said that he read smatterings of it on his old rickety laptop, finding it fun but unremarkable.
Footnote 18. Browning, Through It All, page 65.
He believed that a number of the characters were modelled after lecturers and first-year party animal figures. The winner of the competition was Mulgan Ryan with his 1,000-page space epic titled Baxter and the Space Babes, a novel set in a parallel universe where New Zealand was the forefront of space travel. James K. Baxter and Janet Frame undertake a journey through space and time in order to realign the planets of the solar system using their literary genius. Highly praised it was, especially the 100-page chapter in which Baxter travels through a wormhole while also detailing the history of language through a stream of consciousness. Mulgan remembers meeting George only twice, once at the awards ceremony and the second time in the queue for a double down at the Great King Street Kentucky Fried Chicken. He describes Song as the shyest extrovert I've ever met and the only undergrad who'd ever bothered to read my book.
Footnote 19. Lazenby, The Man Behind the Song, page 91.
Baxter and the Space Babes is now out of print.
Footnote 20. D. Craig, When You've Run Out of Coal, Books to Burn. Oxford, Morse Press, 2040, page 646.
Runner-up was Sonia Bracken's poetry novel, Running Through a Dog Park, Naked with You.
Footnote 21. P. Hunt, Literary Snobbery, Mrs. and Big Mrs. of New Zealand Literature. Gore, Valley of Vision, 2020, page 32.
Bracken claimed more than once to have been close friends with Song throughout their undergrad days. Although George's friends and flatmates claim to have never seen him with her, and neither is there anything in his extensive diary about meeting up with her, she was mentioned in one of Song's monthly handwritten letters to his father. Song describes Sonia Bracken as a Nazi pixie girl who writes poetry about her sex life and scatters them across the campus. A political creature, she flyered me for a Students' Association campaign 3 times in a 10-minute sitting this morning.
Footnote 22. P. Brosnan, The Selected Letters, page 100.
Her poetry books always remained bought, but unread, on Song's bookshelf. In the most unusual turn of events, Song lived next door to an abusive relationship. A sporty med student, who played netball on the weekends, was assaulting her rather timid partner. We don't know why he kept quiet for so long. Biographers R. Moore and G. Lazenby plead Song's ignorance of the situation, arguing that he was unlikely to have been at the flat when most of the assaults took place.
Footnote 23. Moore, Critical Biography, page 603.
Nightingale's candid memoirs are much more illuminating. We all knew what was going on, even George. It was always loud, and for 7 days it was violent, and we were quiet.
Footnote 24. Nightingale, Green Gables, page 90.
Browning was the one to pull the plug. He called the emergency services, but by then it was too late. By that time, the police were dealing with a suicide. Song, racked with guilt, skipped classes for 2 weeks and stayed at a family friend's in Gore.
Footnote 25. Browning, Through It All, page 77.
Browning left the church and Nightingale, unable to remain in Dunedin, booked her flights home earlier, leaving the next month.
Footnote 26. Ibid.
It is unusual for a biographer to insert himself in another person's story. But it must have been at this time that I first met Song. He was handing out bottled water outside the med ball, and I, regrettably intoxicated, conversed with him for about 20 minutes. He was quite eager to tell me, and any of the other partygoers who were in earshot, that the island nation of Tonga was one of the least visited countries in the world. Nightingale was also there, conciliating a crying first year. They were working as a well-oiled pair, and I shook hands with them both. Song, above all, stressed to me the difficulty but importance of living by one's principles. The time had been arranged for Amelia Nightingale's goodbye dinner at the Del Sol on Moriah Place. But due to a number of exams and end-of-semester assignments, Song, Browning and Nightingale were the only ones there.
Footnote 27. Song, Life in Fragments, page 83.
Nightingale attributes that evening out as being the inspiration for her second novel, An Island That We Call Our Own. My second novel and that meal out were all about the same things, I guess. The awkwardness of goodbyes, the guilt of past events, and the things regrettably left unsaid.
Footnote 28. Nightingale, Green Gables, page 91.
Song left the restaurant early, complaining of an upset stomach. Desperate for the bathroom, Song received permission to use the toilets in the Regent Theatre, despite there being a show on. The Regent Theatre, in 2018, were hosting a series of more traditional ballets and operas, and were that night hosting An Evening with Wagner.
Footnote 29. S. T. Connery, Inside the Theatres of Southern New Zealand, Christchurch, No Time to Cry Press, 2022, page 143.
Its opening piece was, by the combined Otago and Canterbury Orchestra, the prelude to Does Rheingold. This is, doubtless, what Song heard in the bathrooms of the Regent Theatre that night on May the 31st at 7:33 p.m. Something had changed. It wasn't an emotional reaction. It was far deeper than that. I was reminded of the beauty of this world, that a violent incident had occurred next door to me and I was in denial, that a good friend, a dear friend, was going back home and I was in denial, and in a time where I had been rush, 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 is one of the only times I was quiet, and I mean truly quiet, with just me and the music.
Footnote 30. Song, Life in Fragments, pages 101 to 102.
A bathroom is an odd location for an epiphany. Yet having examined the acoustics of the Regent Theatre and photos of the old bathrooms, a moment of spiritual, romantic and personal discovery is possible.
Footnote 31. Connery, Theatres of Southern New Zealand, page 140.
Is this a false memory? A fiction installed to enforce a retroactive retelling of his own university life? Regardless of this, Song was objectively correct on at least one front. Everything in his life was about to change.
You've been listening to Benjamin Clough reading his winning story, The Life of George Song, Chapter 3, University Days. You'll find podcasts of all the readings from this series online at oar.org.nz and at otago.ac.nz.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, the Otago Daily Times, University Bookshop, Otago University Press, the English and Linguistics Program at the University of Otago, the University's 150th team, Dunedin City of Literature, and of course, Otago Access Radio.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.